Here we go. Got to punch a few buttons, Jerry. Hang on with us. And we should be a go, I think. Hang on. Give me a sec. One of these things with being live is that you've got like multiple things going on at one time, Jerry. Yeah, we should be live. Welcome, everybody, to Founders Focus, everybody. The show where we get up close and personal with the founders and leaders of the technology businesses changing the way in which we work today. And we're very excited to bring episode 7 to you today. It's been a thrilling series so far. I don't know whether you think this is the case, but we've spoken to some really interesting people and I think learned a lot about what it means to be a leader of a company trying to change behaviors and trying to change how we do things. Today, I'm delighted to welcome to the show a guy who I've just like immediately dive into a great conversation with pre-show, actually. But we're going to have a wonderful chat with Jerry Collier, MD of Hourly by AMS. So, Jerry, welcome to the show. Great to see you here, sir.
Thank you. And great fan of the community and the work you do, highlighting TA Tech and TA Trends. So really great to spend an hour with you.
Yeah, fantastic. Jerry, you're obviously a very busy man. So I always start off the question with, you know, what like essential thing did you cancel in order to come on and have a chat with us today? Was there something?
You know, we're going to come on to sort of, I'm sure we'll talk about leadership later, but transparency and sort of taking off the mask and being real is all part of my philosophy. The thing I'm missing at the moment is feeding my dogs. It's 5 o'clock is dog feed time, actually.
I now feel really bad.
They're being fed. I'm just missing dog feed time.
Oh, I see. Feed. Okay, great. So someone else is feeding them. That's great. I would feel terrible if your dogs are not being fed because we've timed this to 5 o'clock in the afternoon here and 12 midday in the US, East Coast. Anyway, Jerry, great to have you on the show and thank you for joining us. We always want to explore firstly sort of where, you know, the leader is coming from. And you're, if you don't mind me saying, quite an interesting profile for a technology leader of a technology startup. These days, it seems the predominant profile of person is, you know, some young up and coming prodigy who's been a coder and, you know, raised like 20 million at the age of 21 or something. And off he or she goes creating this product. But you've had this amazing, almost dual career. Like you started off in the military, I think. You went straight into the forces after university, I believe, and you spent a good deal of time there. So let's just teleport back to that point, Jerry. You went into the forces. Why? And what did you do there?
So, as a kid, I played with Action Man. I played with little soldiers. I ran around in the woods. All I wanted to do was be a soldier. I went to Sandhurst when I was 21, when I left college. Went to West Point for a little time as well, and then graduated and served in the British Army for 10 years. Most amazing 10 years of my life. Would still be there today, probably if children hadn't come along. So always wanted to be a soldier, and was lucky enough to lead and serve my country.
That's really interesting to hear. And it sounds like you went to some elite places as well. Sandhurst, West Point, these I understand. I mean, I'm not a military person, but I understand these to be officer training type of academies where the leadership within sort of militaries actually go and study and graduate. From these institutions, Jerry, what do you think you've brought out of the military that's been applicable to your work professionally with AMS to begin with, and actually now with Hourly?
Yeah, look, I think there is a misconception for those who may not have a history of service around, you know, in the military, you lead by telling people what to do. I think that's a bit of a misconception. You know, when you look at some of the movies, Full Metal Jacket, not a great recruiting movie for the military. Actually, what military service teaches you is about how to bring disparate assets together, people, equipment, how to create fluid teams, how to achieve objectives, how to lead people through adversity, because the only thing I was ever sure of is whatever plan I'd laid out would not play out the way I just laid that plan out. So how did you adapt? How did you create an environment that people felt empowered as well? And again, I don't think that's that mission command culture is publicized enough in the military. How you're allowed that freedom to act, take action, have the courage to act, have a clarity of purpose. And I think I brought that kind of approach to my leadership in my second career.
You know what? That is fascinating, Jerry, because I think you're right about the preconceptions of military. I mean, maybe this is promoted by Hollywood, of course. You know, we want to create a good movie, good experience. But the concept of a direct commander style, I say you do type of approach seems to be what most civvies would imagine to be the case. But what you're saying is there's actually a lot of decentralization in the military, and you're taught to basically be able to go off script at times when the environment and the situation changes. So it reminds me a little bit of how agile works these days in software development, where you can go too much with the pre-planning and too much with the 3-year-long project design, and it will be executed in this way, very highly structured, but actually you don't know what's going to happen in terms of the market or how the customers are going to respond or whatever's going to go on. You need to actually go through with a very iterative process and really build in agility throughout your team. And I think there's a lot of similarities with what is the you probably tell me a bit more about this, but wasn't it the Prussians or something had reinvented some sort of decentralized sort of way of commanding or delivering orders or so in certain campaigns?
Hung, it's similar to the concept of technical debt, which is I've got to deliver features, and when my product leader is loading our priorities into our sprints, there's always a prioritization. What can we do? What do we have to get to next time? That concept of debt, which is, you've got to do it. It's, do you need to do it now, is exactly the same as a military mission. My goal is to be here. Do I need to take that hill to get here, or can I just get there and come and deal with what's on that hill later? And it's exactly that same always constantly reprioritizing. So it's absolutely fair that there's a real parallel between the agile philosophy and certainly the way I've interpreted my military leadership training, which is around keep the objective in mind. That's time-bound objective. There are things you can't do by rule of law. And then, obviously from a legal or compliance things, there are things we can't do in a sprint. And technically we might not be able to do, but within those bounds, everything is up to us. As long as we keep the objective and our primary purpose and mission in mind, it's about how do we constantly reprioritize the action we're taking and ensure that there is clarity of purpose as well. So that, again, I think sometimes agile can go a little bit, for some people, they might find it a bit chaotic. Because they want to take a more waterfall approach, spend a couple of months, create a nice technical document, create a nice user document, and then go in a sort of deliberate approach through the development cycle. I'm much more aligned, certainly my military training is much more aligned to the agile philosophy, which is keep the objective in mind, reprioritize, and know you're collecting that debt at some time you're going to have to go back and deal with, but keep pushing on.
You know what, it's probably similar to the idea of, I guess the core of Agile, the core of the military training you've received, Jerry, is this just this understanding that you don't know everything, That's the like the key point is you don't know everything. So therefore, if you build a highly structured plan around this thing that has huge gaps in of knowledge, you're gonna have to get very, very lucky for it to actually map to what the reality is. So it makes sense actually to have a different way, agility in this with a small a, in the sense that you can pivot and make these changes on the fly when those times come. Or when there's new information coming at you, which causes the situation to change. Again, using another metaphor from a different place, Mike Tyson, you know, everyone's got a plan until you're being punched in the face. You know, it's like you could overthink what's happening before you get into it. But there's a live opponent in the ring with you. And that person is going to do things that you may not have expected. Your skill as a combatant or a boxer in that scenario is how do you deal with that? How do you manage this changing situation? Which, yeah, go ahead, Jared.
Yeah, no, and how do we keep your team, we've got to be resilient as a team, because that's quite hard work as well. If things aren't going your way when you get hit in the face by Mike Tyson, you know, it's painful. So how do you deal with that? And, you know, if in the fourth round, you're still getting punched in the face. How do you keep going forward? And how do you stay tight as a team? And again, I think, you know, I spend a lot of time thinking about how any of the setbacks or any of the things we're trying, which aren't working, that we're having to adapt, how are they impacting the plan? How are they impacting individuals in the team? Ensuring that we are really tight as we go into round five with Mike Tyson.
Let's talk about resilience, Jerry, because that's a critical, I think all of us this year, last 12 months of, you know, this is a term that we've kind of learned to, you know, from experience. But some people are or have more resilient skills than others. How do you like cultivate a resilience in a team? Is it simply a character trait, or is it something you can do as a leader to make your team more resilient?
Yeah, I start with myself. Am I resilient? It's a weird thing leading this startup in AMS today, which is. I feel like I'm 2 weeks away from failure. I'm a sprint away from failure all the time. Now I use that as an energy just to every 2 weeks is go hard every 2 weeks. I'm able to take that energy in and not let it become a negative. So I start with myself. How do I create resilience in the team? Well, I think have I picked the right people to be part of this journey? And I believe I have. Everyone has a bad day. I have a bad day. You probably have a bad day, huh? And certainly in this last 12, 14 months, it's tested us all because of homeschooling and not being able to get with colleagues. Market conditions have just been, you know, crazy. So I think it's tested all. So I start with, you know, thinking about the things that would drag me down, keep me negative, and make sure I create an early warning system for those things. I make sure I, where possible, select full resilience in the team, and know that at times I'm going to have to put a fire blanket around the team, take them out of the line, say, hey, take some time, just, you know, don't think about work for a moment. There's this great quote. I think it was the CEO of Coca-Cola who said, you get plenty of second chances at work, but you don't get a second chance with your health or with your family. I'm a big believer in that. I think physical resilience as well as mental resilience is really important to guard against the degrading nature of the time we've spent in front of our screens over the last 12 to 14 months.
I'm going to throw an idea that has, as far as I know, very little evidence behind it, but I'm a believer in this. So call it an article of faith. But I believe that you can build mental resilience by building physical resilience. In other words, you can train resilience because if you go and do a physical activity at some stress, some level of stress, you know, let's say you're going for a run or a bike ride, or you're doing some push-ups, let's say, put into context, a year ago, I decided to do push-ups every day. And the rule was I was always going to do one more than the day before, irrespective of what happened. And it obviously gets to a point where it becomes extremely difficult to do one more because you've got to quite a high number, and actually it's really difficult. But one thing I learned after a period of doing it, it became something that was habituated in the way I was doing it. I was going to do this every day, no fail. And I didn't fail. And I'm not a particularly resilient person or a determined person. It was simply a rule that I set in my mind. It became operationalized. And then suddenly it seemed that I was delivering on this. And I just wondered from there, is it possible to kind of trick yourself into into resilience, so to speak, you know?
Gosh, I've probably with my background, I would say yes. But I think that's not for everyone. And I think the wonderful, rich tapestry of our global workforce, there are so many different characters, personalities, situations that people are dealing with. I think I would like to think that, you know, that physical path that you've you know, walked us through there, Hung, is a route to help train resilience. But I think there's gonna be a lot of people who would struggle with that as well. So I think they need other ways to help them deal with their situations. I don't think it's a big topic. And I suppose what I know is if you've only ever had success and never had any, if you've never had failure, or you haven't been encouraged to try and fail and that's been okay, or haven't had a culture where it's okay to experiment and it not work out, I think people suffer from at this moment. I think that those who aren't resilient are really in some distress, and we need to be mindful that all of our teams, some are struggling and some are, you know, thriving, and that will flip flop. And our approach to the way we lead has got to satisfy those ever changing demands of our teams.
So you're saying, yeah, it does. I think what you're saying, Jerry, is you've got to treat everybody as an individual. Yeah, and you need to basically have individual management techniques, I guess. So you can't just one size fits all it, because if you're running a diverse team, you know, whether diversity is coming from mindset or attitude or characters we're talking about, you know, personality traits and so on, then yeah, it's not going to be compatible to just say this is the way. And you need to, I guess, be a much more rounded manager than perhaps, you know, was the case 20, 30 years ago, let's say, when, you know, it was pretty much, you know, this is how it's going to be.
Yep, totally.
You mentioned it was a tough period of time, last 12, 18 months, Jerry. Take us about, like, this all happened in AMS with Auli in the same kind of period, didn't it? So take us through where this idea germinated and why it became a product, and then why has it become like a business unit? It seems like your unusual path is kind of mirrored by the unusual path of the product. So I'd love to learn a bit more about when this idea started.
So I left the army in 1997 and joined AMS very early on, so employee number 9 or 10, something like that. We're now 5,000. So I've been in TA for 25 years. Probably about 3 years ago, I was sitting with colleagues, and I was just frustrated that we talk about candidate experience and talent acquisition. And I think we do a pretty poor job of it. My now product leader and I were talking about, you know, we're just kicking around what we could do to transform the experience. And actually, we made a case to create our own product based on AMS's you know, 5,000 colleagues and all our experience around all these different TA technologies that we've implemented and use around the world. Could we leverage all of that know-how, energy, passion for TA and bring different options to market? So we set out on a path about 3 years ago, writing this business case. We made a strategic acquisition of a TA AI business based out of Canada, Karen AI, about 20 months ago. And they became the nucleus for our engineering group, because one of the things that AMS didn't have at that moment was a heritage in building software. So that was the stepping stone for the hourly journey and where we are today.
Let me just remind people, I'm sure everyone knows AMS, but it could be a few folks don't. Alexander Mann Solutions, one of the biggest names. When I was first coming into the world of recruitment, I knew AMS and Alexander Mann. They were like already, I think, pretty much a prestige brand in the business at this point. So it is very interesting to see what is a kind of a very human consultancy. It's basically been, you know, staffing, it's been RPO, it's been consultancy, management consultancy, stuff like that, and then start to take an interest in product development. Two very different cultures, really, because running a professional services business, just in terms of the economics, very different from running a product-led business when you're building tech. How has that affected you as a manager? Because I think you were managing P&L on in both of those instances, weren't you? On one side, you were managing a budget of a business that was delivering, you know, really, you know, time and labor, so to speak. And now you're building a product that is, you know, a technology that you're going to deliver to clients. From a management point of view, Jerry, how is that different with the business model difference there?
Yeah, look, we have almost 5,000 colleagues who deliver outsourcing and advisory work all around the world. What we hadn't got was a product division, which is what I set up, Hung. You know, effectively, it's a startup within a corporate, which is an interesting position to be in, but one that is incredibly unique, because I can access 5,000 colleagues who can come in and advise when we get stuck on a certain thing. We need to think about the API and how we're going to integrate with a certain set of technologies, or we're thinking about how do we reimagine this part of the process in a different way. We can get access to people who are doing this all day long with real customers, whether it's Delta or Nike or you know, a whole range of our outsourcing and advisory customers. We can bring in that expertise from within AMS to help us and enrich the features and help us prioritize our features in our initiatives. I think it's a wholly positive experience creating a startup in this corporate where I can access this knowledge and expertise, and it's on hand to support our mission.
Is it the first time that there has been a product emerging from this structure, Jerry, or has there been like previous attempts to put products into the market that haven't come out, or maybe they have and I'm not aware of them?
Yeah, so not the first time, but we have a whole bunch of robotic processes using robotic process automation. Now, AMS itself doesn't bring those to market directly. They sit inside our outsourcing and advisory services. So we have built these robotic processes before. This is the first time that we brought engineered product to market like hourly. We have a heritage in building. The first time that I suppose we brought engineering right to the front and creating product that we're, you know, excited to we're just working on release 2.0 at the moment.
Yeah, I mean, very exciting for us to see. I'm personally very excited to see businesses like AMS start doing product actually, because I think we need to almost diversify the types of backgrounds that products emerge from. You know, I alluded to just a little bit earlier when we were talking about your background, Jerry, but I think it's a beneficial thing to get the diversity of product, if you like, diversity of products roots, so to speak. We've talked about Owly, and we haven't probably like summarized what the hell it is first, so people might not know. Could you kind of describe what the product is and what it does and who does it do it for?
Yeah. So let's take a step back. If I was to summarize the market is full of, you know, that we've got these ATSs in the market, whether you like them or don't like them. I believe processing is for chickens, not people. And we have these weapons out there to process, which I don't think are very good. And then the industry has collected itself around vertical solutions. So you can have CRM, video interviewing tools, assessment tools, onboarding tools, recruitment marketing tools, chatbots, a whole range of vertical solutions that you then assemble into a stack of 7 to 9 bits of technology that says you can go from a modern experience to a legacy experience, back into a modern experience, into a legacy experience, into a modern experience, into a legacy experience. And that's our candidate experience. And that kind of is the market today, which I think is pretty horrible, actually. So I challenged the team to think, how would we do this? If we had a build from scratch again, how would we do this? And the answer was probably to turn this on its head and come at it from a horizontal perspective that says, actually, and one of the things I like to do is to look at outside our industry for inspiration. And one of the areas I often look at is in the retail market, because I think they are really progressive in many ways. And actually, how would we personalize this at a category level? So we started with the hourly workforce in North America, pre-pandemic, 80 million Americans in that workforce. And we thought, what would be the hiring process for those hourly workers? And how would we design that in a different way? And then beyond that, what would be the product vision? Once we've designed hourly, then we'll look at salaried. Once we've looked at salaried, we'll go for salaried contract, then for hourly temporary. And then how clip these together with a campus product and actually design personalized experiences for hiring into those categories. So our first product is hourly, high volume, repetitive hiring in the North American marketplace. From the moment someone has a need to the moment that person accepts an offer.
So I'm immediately thinking, when you talk about high volume repeat, maybe this is a retail worker, let's say, or I need like I'm running a pop-up event or something, and I need a bunch of people turning up. Is that the kind of thing, like almost like on-demand workforce?
It's cashiers, it's servers, it's hosts, distribution, warehouse people. It could be truck drivers, healthcare professionals, carers. I suppose a lot of this community have now been acknowledged in the importance that the important role they play in our society, where perhaps they were that forgotten workforce in the past. And we did a little bit of research around this, the forgotten workforce. And I know through this pandemic, I think the role of the driver or the warehouse person or the retail shop assistant, that, you know, they've been amplified because, you know, these people have put themselves in personal danger in many cases in going into the workplace and maintaining, all the services they can to see us, guide us out of the pandemic. But it's actually working with customers, whether it's hotels or distribution companies or airlines or retailers, healthcare providers, home health, or senior living kind of providers. Those kind of organizations who are hiring in often tens and tens of thousands to deliver their services today.
Yeah, fantastic. And basically, you mentioned North America, so right now it's a US focused. That's where the market is. Is there plans to move outside of that market, or do you think that's the basically where the golden goose is?
Yeah, no. So AMS is, I was guided by our CEO, Rosalind Blair, from when I joined in 1997. She's now our executive chair. And her philosophy was never to put a flag in the sand and ask people to come towards it, but was to work with customers who had a challenge and work with those customers and develop a solution. So we'll start with North America, and where, you know, we'll then move to those markets that our customers then need us to be in, whether that's in Germany, whether that's in Mexico, and then moving through LATAM. So North America focused right now. And we have certain geographic plans, but going right back to the beginning of the conversation, we will be agile and adapt to the needs of our customers. If one of our major customers needs us in Mexico at the end of the year, then that's where we'll be.
That's also very fascinating, because it's almost like being part of the AMS network creates almost like an internal marketplace already of ready to go customers that, you know, you can respond to and deliver a customized service to. Whereas let's say traditional startup is, you know, out there in the open sea, so to speak, they've got to spend huge amounts of money trying to hustle and trying to even identify a customer when they're not actually building product. They're literally doing like market development. Whereas you guys have basically you can listen in to what the customer base is telling you, and then be able to identify very quickly where those customers are. So very interesting to see how that affects, the product roadmap and how you build and all that type of stuff, which is super exciting. And you are building it, aren't you, Jerry? So tell us a little bit more about the team. You mentioned, so it started off as a Canadian engineering group. So have you still got like Canadian engineers out there? Is it like scattered around the world in terms of where the group is?
Yeah, no. So we're very proud that we're a global team. The pandemic has made us all go to remote working. In many ways, we were already a remote working team, very comfortable with that. What I miss, though, during the pandemic is those face-to-face opportunities, because about every 6 weeks, we would come together as a group. And there's so much you can achieve these days working remotely with all the tools we have. But I think there's something special when you come together and you just the nuances and the little sort of cues that you might not pick up, or the sort of offline meetings, which is just harder to, well, by definition, you can't orchestrate an offline meeting that, you know, that one person has a conversation with one person that sparks an idea. And so I've really, the one thing I've missed during the pandemic is that opportunity to bring the whole team together every 6 weeks.
Well, here's a leadership challenge for you, Jerry, which is your right front and center for everybody. Like, how do you close that creativity gap? Because building product, I've tried to build product. Anybody out there that's tried to build product will know that, you know, almost like the default is that you've got a bunch of people sitting in a room for like locked in. You know, that's where it all comes out. But now we have to shift to a scenario where we don't have that. We're trying to do things asynchronously. And as you identified, sometimes it's very difficult to spark those inspirational moments or to have those random connections occur. How do you replicate that? Or do we concede that we have to lose the creativity and get it from somewhere else? Thoughts on this, Jerry?
No, look, I think I was just sharing an example of something from a different industry with the team just before I joined today, hun. And my team will say, look, Jerry, that's really nice, but stop sending these things, please, these ideas. I think losing creativity in this moment is an excuse that you haven't tried. There's a way to engage your team. There's a way to encourage everyone to share ideas. I don't think we can use this moment in time as an excuse for losing creativity. I think we just have to try harder and be more committed to it. What have I tried? I've tried a whole range of things. In fact, you know, after this, when we leave the call shortly, hun, there are eight of our team all coming together. We're just going to noodle on a challenge, but something that we have an opportunity to bring different creative approaches to. We're going to sort of kick those creative approaches around for a bit and make a decision on which route we're going to take. And actually breaking breaking some of these challenges down into sort of into elements and bringing both internal to our hourly team, but also AMS colleagues, sometimes partners into that conversation, and laying those out in sort of steps so that we can continue to bring that creative process and the spark of having a diverse team sort of noodling over a problem and wrestling that problem to the ground. I don't subscribe to this moment has challenged creativity. I think I would push back and say, just, you know, you got to try harder.
Yeah,
it's important, got to try harder.
And you've almost got to be creative in getting creativity, right? I mean, back in the day, we might have just been a bit more lazy to say, look, we have got some smart people in the room. At some point, inspiration will strike. We can kind of leave it lie. But now you don't have that. We actually have to be creative in creating the circumstances so that creativity can happen. I'd be interested to know whether anybody else has got any techniques, actually. So if you do have any thoughts, folks, people who are listening in on whether it's LinkedIn or Facebook or on this channel here, if you do have any thoughts, like, how are you managing creativity in your now distributed teams? Are you doing anything to help stimulate this? Or are you a bit like me to kind of given up on it, which, you know, sadly enough, maybe I have, but this conversation's caused me to maybe review my position a little bit. Let me know, comment below. I'd be interested to see whether we can collect some thoughts together on this. Okay, cool. Let's talk a little bit about roadmap, Jerry. 2021, down the pipe, what's happening for hourly customers and people who might be interested in this product suite? You actually mentioned hourly was just one of the products, so potentially there's other things going to happen. Do you have any visibility as to what's, or can you share anything with us that we can expect to see in 2021?
Yeah, so look, I think with 100% focus on hourly right now, there are so many more features and initiatives that we've got to get to. I don't think I've ever worked 25 years in talent acquisition. I don't think I've worked in a more challenging market than we're in right now. That, you know, all the signals are that demand is going through the roof. Peak hiring is going to be September, October. You know, by every measure, the workforce just isn't out there. You know, whether you're looking at searches on Google for jobs, whether you're looking at clicks or clicks to apply rates, costs, just, you know, I think there are three compounding challenges. One is homeschooling, given the amount of colleges and schools that are still remote. I think there are still vaccination rates are increasing rapidly, which is fantastic to see, but there's still a fear around catching COVID. And with the recovery plan as well, the incentives in place, certainly out through September, those three things are causing the workforce to, a significant percentage of the workforce not engage with this opportunity that's now in the market. So it's an incredibly competitive market, which again, informs confirms our roadmap, which is we're focused on, again, not processing people, but actually bringing features to market that help customers deal with that competitive market right now, which is, everyone who does click on your job is, you think of the environment today, if I see a job, I might click on it, it might not be the right shift for me, maybe it's not quite the right location, maybe it's not quite the right role for me, and so I go down this path and I'm getting rejected. But actually, that person is probably a good fit for another one of your roles. How do we redirect those people elegantly and use automation to do that? How do we retarget them if they're genuinely a silver medalist? Or how do we recall them if it's seasonal hires? So we're working on those features to, again, get away from processing and get away from this linear process that people think about, but actually the market right now confirms our roadmap, where we're looking at redirection of candidates, retargeting, recalling. How do we drive referral? How do we put the recruiter salesmanship into a process today and make it much more conversational? And that's really what we're trying to do with Owly.
You know what? That's actually a really good way to encapsulate the marriage between product coming out of a business like AMS, which is, you know, the fundamental core competence of a company like Alexander Mann is going to be the human quality of the staffing that you have, you know. And we all know that the candidates, we can't deny the human touch can often be the decisive factor to how people feel treated when they go through a process. An entirely automated system, and I'm a big fan of automation, by the way, but an entirely automated system oftentimes can produce the wrong emotional impact on people that right now might be in a very fragile place. So I can see the vision sort of that you mentioned where, you know, this product and maybe future products that you produce will basically help accelerate, sort of amplify, if you like, the core competence of AMS, which is, you know, can we bring the human quality and amplify out to that to the candidates out there?
And I think you know, picking up on that, you know, our mission is to make recruiting kind again. And let me put that in context. I've got a rising senior at college in Boston. She's made 47 internship applications in the last 3 months. No company has got back to her. Amplify that by what we do in the market today. There's lots of people applying for jobs, millions of people applying for jobs, who are having, you know, who are broken down or have a poor experience, when actually right now we need the experience to be, to build people up, to offer something back, for the experience to be kind. And if we had unlimited recruiters, that's what we would do. So how does technology play a part in making our process kind again and actually giving back and building people up that says, you know, I didn't get that job, but I've learned something about myself and I've got some feedback and that's great. And how do we make that? And how do we do that at scale? And that is really where the essence of hourly is.
Yeah, I totally accept what you're saying. And, you know, when people, job applications can be super demoralizing. I think sometimes we in the industry can forget that because, you know, if you're watching this show now in some place, probably you're not looking for work. Probably you're on the other side of the fence and may have been some time since you were last a job seeker yourself. But I remember the last time I was sending out applications, this is way back when, but I was probably at a similar stage as your daughter is at the moment. And it was, yeah, wall to wall, reject over time. And it degraded your morale. You know, it was really demoralizing because you end up sort of just taking it personally. You say, oh, I'm not good enough. It's the first thing you think is I'm not good enough. Because especially if you're young in your career, early career folks, they haven't had the experience to know that they're good enough. So that a knockback at that age can be really damaging. And I felt my world getting smaller and smaller over time. You know, I was like lowering my response to those rejections, Jerry, was, oh, I was shooting too high. I need to lower myself to this level because, you know, that's obviously where I should be. And I kept on going until it reached a point where I thought, surely this can't be right. You know, the type of jobs I'm looking at here, surely I'm better than. And it's like a light bulb moment. And I realized, you know what? I can't trust the feedback that I was getting from the market. The feedback from the market was, Hung, you're not getting this job. You're not good enough. You're rejected. I can't trust that because it clearly isn't the case. This job I can totally do. And that's when I thought, right, I need to take radical action and basically, you know, moved cities essentially. Went into the, you know, London to try and hustle my way in. So anyway, just a quick message for people who probably don't need to hear it, but it's worth just underlining, particularly young people. I think it's true for everyone who's on the job market right now involuntarily, but particularly young people who don't yet have the career experience to give them a grounding and a sense of confidence. We have to do a better job. You know, we have to do a better job, and hopefully technology can help. Maury's saying the same thing, you know, similar person, I think, to you, Jerry, you know, founder of a tech business, you know, in recruiting, all of the things lined up. But yeah, you know, young people are knocking on the door and really struggling. Let's focus a little bit on the young people experience, Jerry, as we're talking about it. So I think it is important. There's been a big movement to say, hey, you know, remote work is great. We're going to, you know, this will be the permanent new normal. We want to stick this way. And actually, please don't ask me to go back to the office. And I have a lot of sympathy with that view. In truth, you know, I've worked from home remotely, whatnot, for several years. I enjoy it. It works for me. But I suspect it might be a very bad thing for early talent, Jerry, because didn't you learn a lot from being in on-premise when you were young, right? Yeah. What are your thoughts on that? I mean, is there like a generational difference as to whether remote working is suitable for certain people? More suitable, let's say, for experienced folks, but very unsuitable for young career, early career people.
I think there's two things here. So let me take the question you didn't ask first, Hung, and then I'll answer the question you just asked. The first one, I heard this story the other day where one of my colleagues in the US has a friend, her daughter has been schooling from home for the last 9 months. They don't have a lot of cash and the school was great. They got iPads out and, you know, help the kids. But she sat outside a fast food restaurant in a local town, pirating the Wi-Fi because she doesn't have home broadband. And I think a lot of our recruiting practices today, we talk about diversity and inclusivity, and I don't think they're inclusive from the get-go. They ask for a resume, and I think that's quite a privileged position. A lot of people, you know, how many people have access to people who can help them write resumes? How many don't? How many of our processes require really someone to have home broadband to upload a resume? How many require them really, therefore, to have a desktop infrastructure to be able to upload a resume? I actually think this remote environment has far-reaching opportunity for us as an industry, which is let's get under the bonnet of diversity and inclusion and start to make our process inclusive for all. You know, again, that's one of the philosophies we've taken with Hourly. So that, I suppose that's not it's not answering your question, but I do believe we as an industry need to take a step back and think, is our, the things we ask of our, in our process today, are we by definition inclusive or not? I think we should challenge ourselves a little bit more than we do today. The second point, I think, staying in this remote environment. I believe my son, I've got two older sons and my daughter who's hopefully graduating next year. They can't wait to get into the office. I can't wait to get out of the office. I can't wait now to get back into the office, but you know, pre this, I couldn't wait to get out because I wanted that freedom. But they want to get in and mix, and they want to have their, you know, my son who started his career now misses his social life because that was all around the office. So I think we've got this real mix of generational mix. I think it's easy to overgeneralize.
Generalizations, Jerry. We should just embrace let's just roll them out. I totally agree with you. I think there's going to be a generational, we might end up running on premise as a generational thing. Because there's no question that people who have gone through the mixer over a period of time, there's only so many commutes you can do in your life, I think. You know, if you're in a big city commute, you're there like 2 hours in, 2 hours out, or whatever, there's only so many times you can go to the well and do that before you think enough. But when you're young and entering the world of work, entering a big city for the first time, relocated to it or whatnot, you just want to get in there. You know, you want the office environment, and working from home or working remotely. I mean, I can imagine you're in a graduate recruitment scheme and you're told actually work from home. That's a totally different experience from actually getting in a collegiate environment with other people of similar age, similar kind of career maturation. You're going to learn so much more by being in that place. So I wonder, a radical thought, I wonder whether companies may become kind of on-premise early career, maybe first 5 years of career, but maybe you allow older, more mature people to potentially, you know, step away if that's what they want. Because it may be suddenly, particularly if they've got kids to do this, they need to do a school run suddenly, or they need to do other things that are really important no one else can do.
Yeah.
Those responsibilities.
I, I, I'm not sure it's quite as cut and dry as by those age demographics, but there is definitely those who value that in-person relationship and life around work. And we've built our own virtual internship program. There are progressive companies who've done that who again haven't just said, well, we can't do it, so let's not do it. They've tried to get something done. It's not maybe as satisfactory as that in-person piece, but they haven't, they've produced that virtual internship program, which I think we should celebrate. But I think there's those who want that in person and those who value the flexibility of being able to mix that up a bit. And again, this is about diversity, having people with different preferences right now, collecting them together to go smash a particular mission, to have the courage to act, even if they're not interacting daily with each other in person. I think we're going to have this mix, more and more this mix. We had it beforehand. It's going to be here. I think there is a whole bunch of people who want to go back into the office then, definitely.
Yeah, it's going to be a very interesting challenge. People talk about hybrid as the consensus view. I think that's probably what's going to happen, but there's going to be, I think, a whole load of additional infrastructure we're going to have to set up in order to manage that on a permanent basis. A fellow there, Andrew, thank you for your comment mentioning that, yeah, VR product might be the way. But I don't know whether you have VR, Jerry, or whether there's a plan there, but I've got myself an Oculus, and it's been a lifesaver in this period of time when I've not been able to go out, because it has kind of allowed you to immersively get involved in different environments and different situations. I don't think we're there yet, simply because it's a massive bit of headgear. But give it some time, 5-10 years, we might be at a point where potentially we could replicate some of that digitally. Jerry, we've only got 10 minutes left, so I want to just move forward and ask some kind of leadership tips type of stuff, because I think we can lean a lot on your experience, again, from the military, from being a person that's led business units in AMS, and now being a leader of this product division and potentially new business, leadership lessons that you can give to someone who is, thinking, yeah, I want to step into a role at some point where I'm going to be in charge of a thing. What are the things that you've learned that were kind of late lessons for you, Jerry? You didn't know them. You went ahead in this path, and then reality smacked you in the face, and you thought, "Nah, it's not like this. It's actually this way."
I think first one would be take off the mask. If you make mistakes, own up to them. Be the real person. Don't try and be someone because you've read a book that says this is what a leader does. So take off the mask, because smart people see through that. So don't, that would be the first tip. Second is care about people, genuinely care about people. I think it's called human-centered leadership. Frankly, many people can manage a P&L, manage costs, can manage a development roadmap. But there's people involved in this, and all those people have individual needs, and you've got to care about those people. So again, really care about your people. The next is one I've always had, which is that clarity of purpose. And not only my purpose, but how is it connecting to a higher purpose as well? And make sure that people understand that, have an opportunity to shape that, and then buy into it. So again, it's not being told this is the purpose, but let's shape this purpose together. And let's understand why we're trying to do this and the goal that we're trying to achieve from that. And encouraging people to have the courage to act. Again, Rosalind Blair, who was the founder of AMS back in 1996, always encouraged me to try stuff and make mistakes. Not make them repeatedly, because that's silly. But she gave me the courage to act and try things. And having that kind of leadership cover is something that that I like to bring as well, asking my team to take risks and know I've got their back. And so for me, it would be take off the mask, It would be really care about people, ensure people have a clarity of purpose, and encourage people to act and take risks. Those would be the four, my four principles.
I hope someone's making notes there. They're fantastic to learn a little bit about your leadership philosophy there, Jerry. Diving into just one of those things, because I think it's super interesting about this, the second point you mentioned about the requirement to care about people beyond the technicalities of, you know, managing a P&L, let's say. With Half Nights was the kind of automation side of things, where we're getting a lot of software that's going to help us start making P&L decisions, right? It's going to help start, you know, managing a lot of the things managers used to do. Do you think that sort of this component is going to expand in terms of the sorts of things managers will need to do? So in other words, it will become more human as tooling and technology takes away the weight of the other stuff that managers or leaders used to do?
Oh, I want to say yes. I think task, action, monitoring, data-driven alerts, there's a whole bunch of stuff we can do to make the use of our, you know, time more efficient, which I suppose, Hung, means, you know, what's the role of the person in the world? To lead and connect with other people, to create diverse teams, to encourage and embolden them to take swift and decisive action, to follow their conviction, to step out when they're struggling a bit, and to know they've got the support of others to step out and then come back in when they're ready to come back in. So yes, I believe that's true, which is, you know, there are more and more of the transaction of work can be automated. So what's left? Well, it's the human side. It's that human leadership, the human experiences, the teams. It's creating those diverse, high-performing teams.
Did you read that post? I put it in the newsletter this Sunday about, let's automate the CEO. And I think it was written a little bit in jest, that particular essay. But then you read into it a little bit more, you're like, hang on, it's not entirely a joke. Because what they're saying is, actually, we think of automation typically from bottom up. We think, oh, it's the people at the bottom end of the pyramid. If you want to, you know, look at a hierarchy point of view, they're the ones that are in danger. They're going to be automated out. But why don't you start at the top? Because actually, if a lot of the CEOing or leadership actually is just looking at what is the optimal decision to make, let's say on a spreadsheet point of view, you can, you know, a machine can do that. You know, it could recommend a course of action and even execute the course of action. But the thing that a machine cannot do is to be sensitive of the human team around it. And that is going to be the more important component to anything, because that currently is still what makes a team, still what makes a business.
I might not go as far to say that we can automate the CEO, although CEO as a service is perhaps something we should think about. But you're right. If your workday is transactional and transactional only, a lot of transactions can be automated in the future. So it's, you know, the role of the leader, I think it's about creating an environment for encouraging the teams to be creative, to take risks, and to work problems fast and quickly to ensure that the mission is delivered on, going back to former life speak.
No, I mean, I love the focus, Jerry. The idea of things being goal-driven, I think, is something maybe we need to really embed in what we're doing, because that's how you achieve things. Without sort of this concept of mission delivery, I think things can just slide without end, and then nothing gets delivered. Jerry, we're coming to the end of our conversation. I wish we had more time, but obviously you are an MD of Owly, so you've got some MDing stuff to do. What are you going to do after this call? I mean, obviously you're going to check on the dogs and make sure they're well fed. But after that, what other things need to be done for the business?
Oh, but to the conversation earlier, we've got a 90-minute proposition workshop in 30 minutes kicking off, talking about one of our features, and we've got options in terms of which direction do we go. So really looking forward to that. Seven colleagues joining that. Can't wait for that session. It's going to be really exciting.
Fantastic stuff. Jerry Collier, thank you so much for your time. It's been an absolute pleasure having you on Founders Focus. If the people who are listening to this want to get in touch with you or find out more about Hourly, find out more about AMS, how do they do that? What's the best way?
Yeah, if they go to our AMS's website, weareams.com, or go to wearehourly.com, they can follow us on our LinkedIn handle at wearehourly. If anyone would like more details, then please just get in touch.
Fantastic. Jerry, you have a good day. It's been wonderful having you on the show.
Great speaking. Thanks, everyone.
What a wonderful conversation with Jerry Collier. A very interesting chat. I thoroughly recommend you connect with Jerry online. I think you can learn a lot from his life journey and career journey to date. I'm very excited to see this innovation emerging from, these blue chip staffing businesses and management consultancy businesses. So do check out Hourly by AMS. Okay, that's about it, folks. We're going to keep lining up these leaders, and it's going to be another fascinating conversation. We've got some excellent product leaders coming up soon. Some more news on that. Follow the channel if you're interested to know more. Have a good day, everyone.